Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to season 4 of the Umayyad Caliphate. Inshallah, we'll keep the introduction short and get right into the story, but we have to do some sort of introduction. Now, this season is going to be a little different from previous seasons. The first three seasons of the Umayyad Caliphate followed a similar pattern as the main Islamic history podcast. Each season was made up of around 13 episodes covering a specific period of time. And each episode was roughly 25 to 35 minutes long and came out regularly about once a week. I sometimes didn't quite make that, but generally speaking, once a week. Well, season 4 is going to be different. It's going to be different in that there will only be 3 episodes. Hold on, don't panic, inshallah, don't panic. However, each episode will be much longer than just 25 to 35 minutes. I don't know yet because I'm recording this introduction right before I start the story, but I know that each episode, at least this episode, certainly is going to be well over an hour long. You probably know already because you're seeing it in your podcast app, but I don't know how long it's going to be because I haven't recorded it yet. I'm about to do that in just a moment. Now, there are a few reasons for making this change. First of all, trying to push out a new episode every week the way I did it previously, that generally made me rush through the process of researching the story and then building the story. And that also, in turn, took away from the joy of making this show. I mean, it is joyful. I enjoy the process of researching and story building, but when you have to rush it out, it's not so much fun. And this, in turn, made me want to get it over with as soon as possible. I was doing something I wasn't really enjoying, and so I wanted to get it over with, which made me rush, and the cycle kind of self-fulfilled itself, so to speak. However, doing longer and fewer episodes helps me to just sit back, calm down, and do what I really enjoy: researching, connecting the dots, and building an amazing story. Inshallah, I hope you will see how much joy I've had in making this episode. Another thing we're going to get away from will be the recap. Generally speaking, in previous episodes of the Umayyad Caliphate, I usually devoted the first episode to recapping the previous seasons. I will devote the first episode of the season to recap the story of the Umayyads up to that point in history. We're not going to do that this time. I will recap the last episode of the previous season of season 3 because some of it connects to this episode and it kind of has to be at least summarized. But I'm not going to waste your time and mine by giving you a bunch of information that you should already have. If you're new to this and this is your first episode, then by all means, you can continue going on from here if you like, or just go back and listen to the first 3 seasons of the Umayyad Caliphate, or even go back and listen to the story of Ibn Zubayr, or go back and listen to the 4 Righteous Caliphs. There's lots of things you can listen to. The 4 Righteous Caliphs is part of the main Islamic history podcast. I think that was season 2. Yeah, starts with Abu Bakr. Season 2 of the Islamic history podcast. I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed making this first episode. I haven't had this much fun making a podcast episode in a long time. I mean, just being able to take my time and dig into the research and the personalities behind the story, it was just amazing. Inshallah, I'm hoping that you can hear how much fun a history nerd like me had with this story. Now, inshallah, this season, season 4 of the Umayyad Caliphate, will cover the years 106 to 120 AH, which roughly corresponds to 724 to 738 CE. Hisham ibn Abdul Malik will be the caliph for this entire period. This is really going to chronicle the beginning of the decline of the Umayyad Caliphate, even though nobody at that time really knows it yet. But we will see. As a listener, as the observer, we will see how the military victories are becoming more rare and they're becoming more costly. We'll see how the corruption, the tribalism, and the mistreatment of the Mawali, the non-Arab Muslims, how that continues to eat away at the core of the Umayyad regime. And inshallah, we'll also see how the Umayyad ignorance of statecraft and their never-ending warfare policy was slowly wearing them down. In short, we're going to see how and why the Umayyads were pretty good conquerors, but not very good rulers. And their ability to rule was hampered by being one of the largest empires in human history at a time before modern transportation and communication existed. And so with that, let's get into this first episode where we cover the years 106 AH to 109 AH. Let's begin with the military outlook in 106 AH. Simply put, the Umayyad military was spread too thin. The Khilafat, the Umayyad Caliphate, now covered a wide swath of geography from Spain to China to India. Most of the previous Umayyad military campaigns had been taken opportunistically. That means the Umayyads attacked wherever they thought they could easily achieve victory. But after they got that victory, very little thought was put into defending and governing these areas where they conquered. So this left many unconquered pockets throughout the empire, particularly in difficult mountainous areas. Now you go and take a look at a map of the Umayyad Caliphate, you see this big splotch of green or red or whatever the color may be going from Spain all the way to India. But the truth of the matter is that within that big splotch of green, there would be little pockets that the Umayyads had no control over. For instance, Afghanistan. There are pockets in the mountains of Afghanistan that the Umayyads never really fully controlled. They were lucky if they were able to get a tribute from the people living in that area, and we're going to see that that didn't happen all the time either. Also, the Atlas Mountains of North Africa, and then the northern mountains of Spain. So by Hisham's reign, by the time that Hisham ibn Abdul Malik was in control, most of the easy targets within this area had already been conquered. So what remained, the parts that remained, were the better organized kingdoms and empires, and of course these mountainous areas that they couldn't get into, at least not easily. So these areas that were better organized and had better militaries and weren't easy pushovers, these were the Byzantines in Anatolia and Constantinople, the Gauls in Spain, the Khazar Turkish Khanate in the Caucasus Mountains, and the Turgesh Turkish Khanate of Central Asia. We'll go into all of these different regimes right now, actually. First comes the Byzantines. Now, the Byzantines were the primary enemy of the Umayyad Caliphate. Now, we know that over the years prior to the Umayyads, the Byzantines had lost much of their empire to the Muslims. So all that was left of the Byzantine Empire was Anatolia, that's what is mostly roughly modern Turkey, Greece, parts of Italy, and a few Mediterranean islands, which included Sicily. The Byzantines knew that they couldn't take on the Umayyads directly. They didn't have the strength. The Umayyads were way larger than the Byzantine Empire. The Byzantines knew they couldn't fight the Umayyads offensively. They couldn't take action directly against the Umayyads. They could do raids here and there, but they had no hope of actually conquering or reconquering the territory that they had lost to the Umayyads. That was a done deal. The Byzantines, instead, they had to take a defensive approach. And they also used their mastery of the sea and the mountains of Anatolia as a defensive bulwark against the Umayyad armies. So this forced the Umayyads, this forced the Muslims, actually, to fight in Anatolia, which was far from their base in Syria. Of course, the Umayyad capital was in Damascus, though Hisham ibn Abdul Malik didn't really spend that much time in Damascus. He lived else in other parts of Syria. But still, the Umayyad base was in what we now would now consider Syria or Hisham. So in order to fight the Byzantines, the Umayyads would have to send their armies further and further out, deeper and deeper into Anatolia, further away from their base, which made it very expensive and very difficult to support these troops because, of course, they were further away from the base. It also made it nearly impossible to escape if things went south. Put it like this. Let's say that the Umayyad army was somewhere in the central region of Anatolia. They're fighting. Things go bad, they lose, they have to retreat. They don't own any of that territory. They don't control much of that territory in Anatolia. They had to flee all the way from the middle of Anatolia to Syria on horseback while fending off from their enemies who were chasing them the whole time. Do you know how difficult that would be? So this made fighting in Anatolia very sort of hopscotch, sort of patchwork, sort of affair. They'll conquer a fortress here, conquer a city there, but never really conquer much of Anatolia. And as we mentioned, the Byzantines were dominant in the sea. Naval expeditions were very dangerous and expensive for the Umayyads. Also, most Umayyad ships were operated by Coptic Christians living under Umayyad rule, and the Umayyads didn't really trust these Coptic Christians when they were fighting against Byzantine Christians. They didn't really trust them. So the Umayyads had a navy, but it wasn't really a great navy, and they had to depend on people who they felt were kind of shaky in their loyalty. And also, without a navy, the Umayyads never really had a strong chance to conquer Constantinople, which at that time was the Byzantine capital. So that's the situation with the Byzantines. On to the Caucasus Khazars. In the Caucasus, there was a fierce and unstable struggle between the Muslims, that is the Umayyads, and the Khazars of the Caucasus. And this conflict doesn't get that much attention because there's very limited resources discussing it. The Caucasus front was especially important to the Umayyads because of how close it was to the core of their caliphate, that is Syria. If you look at any map and just see how close the Caucasus area is to Syria. There was also the concern that the Khazars in the Caucasus might ally with the Byzantines and they might score some significant gains against the Umayyads militarily. Now, the main area of conflict was in what is now present-day Azerbaijan and Dagestan, which is a part of Russia. The Umayyad-controlled region of the Caucasus bordered Christian Georgia and Armenia to the west. Georgia was still independent, but most of Armenia was under Muslim control at this time, even though the Byzantines, however, controlled a small portion in the west. Both Muslims and Byzantines tried to avoid conflict with the Armenians, and they were happy with just collecting tribute and nominal allegiance from the Armenians. This arrangement, however, changed when the Umayyad governor of Azerbaijan, a man named Muhammad ibn Marwan, he attempted to fully annex Armenia, and the Armenians responded by allying with the Byzantines. So in the fighting that followed, the Armenians and the Byzantines together initially defeated the Umayyads and killed thousands of troops and the Muslim sub-governor of Azerbaijan. This occurred roughly around 703 CE, which is around 84 AH. The governor, Muhammad ibn Marwan, he retaliated in 705 CE, that is 86 AH, and this time the Muslims defeated the Byzantines and the Armenians and killed all of the rebellious Armenian princes. Muhammad ibn Marwan was eventually succeeded by another man named Abdulaziz ibn Hatim al-Bahili as the governor of Azerbaijan, and this new governor helped to rebuild the capital in Armenia and established a Muslim garrison in Armenia. And from that point forward, Armenia was kept under tighter Muslim control. As we mentioned before, they kind of left them alone, just say, don't cause trouble, pay your taxes, and at least say that you are allied with us. But now the Umayyads tried to exert more control, but it was still not as tightly controlled as other parts of the Umayyad Khilafat at that time. Generally speaking, the Armenians were pleased with this new governor, Abdulaziz, and they accepted living under Muslim rule. However, interestingly, not many Armenians actually accepted Islam as a religion. And there are some sources, I've mentioned this, I believe, in previous seasons of the Islamic History Podcast, there are some sources that say that those Armenians who did accept Islam, those are the people that we now call Kurds, and Allah knows best. The next major polity or empire that the Umayyads had to deal with was the Khazar Khanate. Now, unlike the Caucasus states, which were very fragmented, The Khazars had a strong state that was very similar to the Byzantines. They had a strong state like the Byzantines, but the Khazars were more rural than the Byzantines were. The Byzantines were more urban with larger cities, whereas the Khazars were more rural. The Khazar Khanate was located just north of the Caucasus, stretching from the Volga rivers and the Don rivers in what is now like Ukraine. So it stretched from like Ukraine to Russia, north of the Caucasus, all the way into western Kazakhstan. You may need a map to kind of see how all of this looked. The Khazars, unlike the Caucasus Khazars, the Khazar Khanate, they had an alliance with the Byzantines for most of the century. Interestingly, however, the Khazar nobility never converted to Christianity. Instead, many of them, the nobility of the Khazars, they converted to Judaism around 740 CE, roughly 122 AH. That's a little bit before the time we're talking about. Our time starts within 124 AH. So now we're looking at a few years earlier, many of these Khazar nobles converted to Judaism. Now, why did this happen? How did this happen? Many Jewish people, several Jews had migrated to this region, escaping or fleeing from persecution from the Byzantines. That's no surprise. Despite however people try to say that Muslims hate Jews and all that kind of stuff, the Christians of the world have been persecuting Jews way longer than, and much more, much worse than Muslims have. Muslim persecution of Jews, it happened, but it was rare. Christian persecution of Jews was systemic. Anyway, it's neither here nor there. Now, I got to admit that in my research, it's not exactly clear when this conversion to Judaism happened. So we have all of these Jews from other parts of Europe, mostly under Byzantine control, under Byzantine rule, escaping to these different parts of Russia or Ukraine or parts of Kazakhstan. And somehow or another, they convinced some of, or they influenced, I won't say convinced, they influenced some of the Khazar nobility to convert to Judaism. It's not exactly sure when this conversion happened. We know it was roughly around 740 CE. And we're also not sure if it spread beyond the nobility, beyond the elites of society, and if not, why didn't it? Or if it did, why did it? And it shouldn't come as a surprise, however, that I found lots of Israeli historians who tried to dispute that this ever happened. But here is something that I found, some research that I found I want to read to you. I'm going to read this excerpt. Both al-Mas'udi and ad-Dimishki dated the conversion of the Khazar king to the reign of the Abbasid caliph Harun al-Rashid, AH 170 to 178, AD 786 to 809. This seems to be inconsistent with the Jewish tradition preserved in the Khuzari, which dated the conversion to more than half a century earlier, circa 730 to 740. The contradiction is readily resolved, however, if one considers that the Muslim historians most probably understood the Khazar conversion to have occurred with its second stage, that is, when the Khazar king, Obadiah, accepted the Jewish religion publicly and introduced the corresponding legal reforms, rather than the first, that is, when General Bolyan converted privately. This differing view was all the more likely because, in 737, at about the time of the conversion's first stage, the supreme Khazar ruler, the Emperor Khokan, converted to Islam. The Khazar Kingdom's Conversion to Judaism, Omelyan Pritsak, Harvard Ukrainian Studies, Volume 2, Number 3, September 1978. So I encourage you, if you're interested in that sort of thing, to look further into this conversion of certain Khazar nobility to Judaism. Something to think about. Anyway, moving on with the story. Now, the Khazars were pretty formidable foes, mostly due to their nomadic lifestyle and their high mobility and warfare. Serious Muslim versus Khazar hostilities began with Maslamah ibn Abdul Malik's campaign in the region around 715 CE, that is 96 AH. Serious Muslim-Khazar hostilities began with the campaign of Maslamah ibn Abdul Malik, that is Hisham ibn Abdul Malik's half-brother, in the region around 715 CE or 96 AH. Around the same time, a little bit before this actually, Emperor Justinian II, the Byzantine Emperor Justinian II, he married a Khazar princess. This occurred around 705 CE. To hear the full episode, subscribe to Islamic History Exclusive, available at patreon.com/Islamic History and on Apple, Spotify, and Podbean.